Hello, welcome to Art Talks with Al Ninod. Catch up with the latest Art Talks, conversations, interviews on contemporary art in Ghana. These episodes are recordings of Art Talks, art seminars, interviews gathered from different art spaces in Ghana and around the world.
So for the first test, we had artists like Nebeda Alec and Katia Budarel, Nina Oshamek, Ikone Ajijai, Theo Shetu was there, Eric JV, Halima Haruna, Fanyana Kavagane, Amina Kadush, Muna Karai, Senko Santini, Kadito Leliet, Amadou Samaseku, Ubebeze, Siwani, Gingote. And you'll see how I'll give you a sense of the works. What I'm doing now is giving you the structure and the premises. After I'll play a short video to give you a good sense of how the works were experienced, displayed, you know. Apart from highlighting collectives of this edition of the Biennale, what we did was also to put a focus on people who had historically been marginalized from my photography itself. The history of photography as it's told tends to elude women. It tends to lead, other non-white male voices in it. And so, since we're coming from an other perspective anyway, from an outsider's view, from the space where we are asserting ourselves, not just as a singular thing, we were using this also to recognize the various sort of subjects or subjectivities that could express themselves through photography. And so, yeah, we try to open up the scope of participation. So these are works from the artists earlier listed, just to give you a sense of it. Some of them are videos, others are installations, others are printed photographs, others are collages, and so forth. On displacement, errantry, and diasporas, the third verse, what we did, the artists were Emmanuel Mbia Jaffe, Yannick Anton, Jean-Pierre Bukolo, Amsa Tujalo, Yagazi Emezi, Adama Jalo, Mansour Sis Kanakasi, Godelieve Kabuna Kasangati, Harun Morrison and Helen Walker, Keta Kisheth, Mohamed Tara, Andrew Tabango, Maya Sanchez, Renero, Milena Valcarcel. The participants didn't belong to one specific generation, so we can't say, okay, well, we're showing artists from ages 25 to 35, for example, some over 70 years old, some in the 80s, Fishaban, as we, Mrs. Felicia is, I think, 83 now, and she's one of the artists we featured. So it was intergenerational, it was open in that sense as well. So for the chapter 4 on the possibility of hope and the future of promise, or the future as promise, there was Roger Annis, Jody Biba, Cedric Kisham, Kemi Safia Matsu, Fotutala Masasi, Maxime Jean-Baptiste, Santiago Mostyn, Khalid Nemawi, Yvonne Gassam, Dustin Thierry, Amjad Traore, Nada Sadalas, and Selassie Susu. These are from everywhere, from North Africa to Southern Africa to Latin America to from everywhere around the globe, essentially. And that's one of the exciting things about the show, to be able to deal with this multiplicity. of perspectives, and that complements the theme, the streams of consciousness, is really about that, you know, opening up to the multiplicity. And there are political dimensions to this. There are reactionary dimensions to this. So how to work through it is a thing in itself, you know. So we have a category like solid rocks, and the solid rocks was dedicated to people who we considered as you know, pioneers in a way, or progenitors, or those who have, through their tutelage or through their practices, been able to influence or inspire other people. And some, or the list we use, is Frisch Urban, who is arguably the first known woman photographer. Akintola Akimi, who I earlier introduced, she also was a curatorial advisor for the team. Jihan El Tahir, Ahmed Francis, Liz Johnson Arthur, Yustaki Neves, Yusuf Solodogo, and Deborah Willis. Peace. And so, yeah, these were the collectives we show were AFPM, which is an abbreviation for an association of women photographers based in Mali. Collective 220, Iniso Labanti, Invisible Borders, Kamoinde, who have a collective practice that dates back to the 60s in the United States. There's Mfon, women photographers based in the diaspora. Then there's the Autolith group, there's K2D, Collective Two Dimension, and Collective Orchestra B. So this will give you an impression of some of the works we had from them. And there were special projects. T.S. Gates's two-channel projection was submitted for the exhibition. So the special projects are the ones we invited from artists, guest curators, and who became my kind of sub-exhibitions in the main exhibition. So they brought their own. Some, you know, had like fully planned out exhibitions, and then, you know, put them in the context of the show, and it worked really. Was really interesting to see these micro shows happening in the Biennale. So Tiesta Gates's "Do You Hear Me Calling" was one of them. Fatima Bokum's "Muso Katuma Sera." There's Nakana Diakite Prats with Jatiki, in short. There's Uche James Iroha with the works of Tola Ukoya, who was a photographer who was also practicing, I think, around the 60s, you know, but who didn't come into the limelight until his passing. And so, what Iroha wanted to do was to use the Biennale as a beginning point to deal with this photographer, or make a case for the compelling work that this photographer did. And so they showed, I think, 12 or 13 of his prints, which were really strong in black and white. Raison Nedu's Legends of the Casbah was also part of it. Marizon is a curator from South Africa who brought the perspective of Indians who have lived in South Africa all their lives. And it just goes through the various you know, histories and life experiences of their own cultural subgroup. There was Françoise Huguier, who's one of the founders of the Biennale. She had a project called Alès Débat Macro, which was a video projection I showed in the exhibition. There was a tribute to John Fleetwood, curated a tribute to David Goldblatt, and that was a show that was at the Institut Français. And we had the photography in family homes, so the three family homes who opened up their doors to audiences from all over the world to come. And some intrusively, others not so much. So yeah, and this exhibition was complemented by public programs, which we programmed talks, fora, film screenings, so many other things emerged from that. And the Rencontre, as we may know, is the only, it's the longest running international exhibition dedicated to still a moving image in Africa, and one of the few in the world. So for me, this was an opportunity to discuss or to think about really to think about its place in the broader context of the history of biennials in the world. Biennials are becoming notoriously complicit in the so-called privatization of everything. You know? So how do you work through a framework that is potentially complicit in exploitation in many forms? And so with the passing last year of African curators, BC Silva and Okwin Wizo. BC is a former, or she had curated an edition of the Quran Pont, and Okwin Wizo, we wanted to use this to commemorate their legacy in a way, so there were awards dedicated to their life work, which we gave to artists that were deserving. The Biennale is organized, it has historically been funded by the Institut Français, which is based in France. And then how it works is that most of the printing of the photographs are done in France and then brought to Mali. In this edition, it wasn't exclusively so for the Institut Français. So it's the plan is to gradually have the Malian state fully fund the Biennale. And so this is the first part of why we call it the transitional Biennale, where the Institut Français and the Ministry of Culture in Mali split the budget. So it was a 50-50. And based on this, it marks the beginning of a possible turnover for the absolute running of the Malian for them or by the Malian state. And so there are prospects that are hopeful in that regard, and then this made us. Sorry. Okay. So So this meant for particularly when I went to the artistic director who insisted that we print the majority of the works for the exhibition in Mali. And so that means that you have to find competent people to do this work. If they had the equipment, if they had the logistics, they had the materials to make this happen. And so we had to go out of our way to find such people. And they existed. So through the back and forth, quality checks and so forth, we were able to get close to what we desired. So this is a general framework for the rencontre, and I will just play you a video to give you a sense of what was happening in the exhibitions. Right, so these are visuals of the sites, so the various exhibition venues. This is Felicia Evans' work, for example. So you see the scale from a very intimate one into like a billboard one. This is a project by T.S. Gates, the two-chan video projection. Here is at the Memorial Mongolibo Kita. This is JP's work for the Biennale. Really look, the photograph as object, how it could become an object, how it doesn't stay flat. These were questions that were raised or addressed by many of the artists. Some preferred a flat approach, others preferred a performative approach, others were more experimental. Here's one of the public, the talk sessions we had. They were spread across the venues. This is the Institut Français where the Go Black exhibition opened, or the tribute to Go Black's work, 5 photographers, 5 other photographers' works. So, just to give you a sense of how this opening up the forms, what was possible, what could be done, how painting even could enter the fray. This is the conservatoire. Some of the drawings that were animated, some were handmade drawings, some were thinking openly about the practice or the form of photography. This was a karaoke set, for example. Audience to come and grab a mic and speak for the person on the screen. Thank you. Magambo, the work that I just played, there was a video projection initially, and then so we played it, and there was a moment in the opening week that she intervened on the video by making the drawings, so the markings on the walls. And then after that, you know, so that live element brings its own dynamics to the experience of the work. And then once that is finished, the markings are left on the wall, and the video remains or continues to play. And so in a work like this, it's not only video, it's not only performance, it's not only drawing, right? It's not only painting. So a singular work has acquired so many layers, and it's hard to compartmentalize and say this is that. These were some of the challenges and the questions that we openly welcome in the Biennale. So yeah, the scenography, you see that some of it attempts to achieve this abstract fluidity that we're talking about. Here we have the family homes that the show extended into, and you see that they are not defined by the traditional characteristics of an exhibition space. So people's homes, they decide. These were like guest curated projects in their own right. They made the decisions on how to allow people in, how to create an experience for audiences to engage. And that autonomy also had its place in the show. Right, so this is pretty much where I will leave it at. And thank you all.
Once again, and let's put our hands together for him. We're going to open it up, but before I do that, I have some questions of my own. At least a question of my own. And before I pass the mic off, because I would like to know, I mean, you had specific roles as curators, and interested in whether those roles stayed rigid or in solidarity with the theme, you had fluid roles where you could.
I joined the team around March last year. It happened in the open November. So we had roughly 8 to 9 months to put this to together. So we had to really double time, you know, and we had to multitask. But initially we had clearly put each other, because there was four of us, we could share the work, but also when it was necessary to work together, we all did. Now, for example, for the catalog, putting the bios and the images and the artist's works together, it took all of us, because that was we had opened Pandora's box and we had to, you know, come to terms with it. So no one person could have done that. So we shared the artists, okay, you write 10 bios. And then the public program also had a leader. So we had leaders for all the various things. I was leading the film program and other things. Astrid was leading production. Aziza was leading a public program. Bonaventure was overseeing all these things. Barry also had his own tasks. So there was it got overwhelming at certain points, and we just had to work as a team to mitigate the stress levels and so forth. But yeah, so we had to play both, do our assigned tasks, but also help out the next person. Mm-hmm.
Hi guys, my name is Anapis. I just want to know how much it costs to put everything together.
So for something like this, there were real challenges with the budget, particularly because it was split between the state and the Malian state and the Ministry of Finance. So it was clear who had to provide for what, but sometimes there was the money would either arrive later or not at the moment that you paid, so you had to provide. And all of this triennial happened with half of the budget, right? And so there were, you know, just huge. That it happened was at this scale is as miraculous as anything. It had to take a lot of inventiveness and a lot of will, you know, for the even on the part of the state, because the museums and things that we were using, it had to be paid for. The staff who were manning it also had to be catered for on Sunday. It cost not less than 200,000 euros to put it together. Yeah, but the budget was more than that. So we had to work within the limitations and the constraints that we had to make it happen.
There's a question.
Was there a criteria in selecting the curators and the co-curators? And if there was any, what was the criteria? Because there are a lot of curators. So how did they select you people?
Well, thank you for that. I want to acknowledge. I want to say Happy New Year to you. Well, I wouldn't say there was a. It's. Okay, so I'll approach the question from a few angles to be able to deal with it well. Mainstream exhibition making is especially on the scale of the large scale international exhibitions, mainly biennials, triennials, quinquennials, any of these things. What is happening is that based on the scale, it's experiencing its own crisis in our time. That we have to, you know, improvise in how we approach this problem. If you have 85 over, you know, or around that, close to 90 participants or close to 90 projects in an exhibition, to have a single curator, you know, work on it can be overwhelming. Uh-huh. And to approach it in the diversity that is possible, you need, even in a curatorial team, you need to enrich it, you know, with different perspectives. So I don't share your view that it's too many curators.
No, I didn't say too many curators.
There are many curators.
No, you have to select you and your co-curators.
Okay. Okay, so I was, but yeah, so I'm building up to that. So the point is, you need to be able to diversify the curatorial approach enough to be able to absorb, you know, the shocks, because every argument you pose will have its counter argument. So you have to factor it in your planning. And if you, so for me, I met an auditor very, I didn't know him personally until 2018. Yeah, so he knew me of my work, and he approached me while I was in Berlin and asked me if I would like to come with him. And I asked him why. He said, you know, he had been following my work. And so that is, I suppose, the criteria for me. But there were other, like Aziza, for example, had worked with him previously on Documenta, when they worked on it. And then Astrid was through Ego, you know, so her work is well known in Mali. She's between Mali and France. So she works in those regions, and we needed, you know, so just the experiences we all brought were necessary to the show. And so that's how it came together.
Yeah, busy. As an image maker myself, these are still my images that I've been pulling every day. Are these exhibitions still relevant from your point of view? And also coming from, I think this came directly after Spectacle Speculations for you, right? So how did you go into this? From that experience, and what did you intend to achieve with this, even though you were among like a lot of curators?
So apart from the broader curatorial vision, you know, set for the Biennale, we all accepted our individual perspectives in essays in the reader. So I would, but I think that is one of the ways that they respond to myself, that you can see where each character is approaching the subject. But for me, coming, so as Francis mentioned, Spectacles, Speculations is an exhibition of curator in 2018 in Moscow. And it was not exclusively dedicated to video photography, but coming from there, I knew that I was interested in images or imaging at its core. So the technologies that are used to make images or to create images, be they holograms, you know, be they, you know, because the projector is beaming light, and the light rays, if they find an opaque surface, they give you images. Yeah, the physics that goes into this, I'm interested. So from the technological angle, from an artistic angle, because when a thing is not necessarily artistic, it is when, you know, certain freedoms or experimentations are brought to it, right? So if I have a camera, I could let the laws of how it works dictate what I make, you know? And I won't, if I don't push it beyond its limit, it is, I stay within that safe zone. For me, the art happens when
you push it beyond that space, right? And so, coming into this Biennale, I was fascinated to learn about what image makers around the world, because if Spectacles, Speculations has 16 artists, this was potentially exposing me to 300 artists, right? Over 300, but I think there were 330 applications we received. You see, so that was the exciting part for me. From that, Spectacles was not local in the sense that, you know, because it had artists from South America and in Europe, but it was also, this was an opportunity to really delve into, you know, image making, the particularities of it, and the diversity that I could experience. And that was the part that was, that was the real for me. That's why I'm here.
I'm saying this that as a performance artist, I think it was very brilliant, whoever Sagi was, to put in the karaoke. And I'm saying this because usually when we go for exhibitions like this, it's very silent and everything is done, and you take whatever feelings you have, whatever ideas you have, you take it away. But with karaoke there, you can be at least express them and leave a comment. So it's really nice when sometimes some exhibitions actually leave a wall for the audience to actually write their thoughts. And I think karaoke is also another way to go. But wasn't the team afraid that that could have taken away from the main focus of the exhibition, because we're here to see images and not see people before.
Yeah. Yes, it was. Yeah, that's very true, and it is part of why we considered that project, so that we could, because part of the concern was to not, especially with photography and video, it tends to privilege the eye as its primary sensory organ. And historically, if you look at the especially for, I say I'm speaking from a point of view of a Ghanaian, the colonial experience, the colonialists, what they did in their interpretation of art and the dogma they implemented of what art is was retinal. It was exclusively retinal. And so it orients you to think about art as a usually, you know, a flat thing, or it's a drawing, it's a painting. If it's sculpture, it's an autonomous object, you know, on a platform or something like that. And so some of the silent, you know, politics that underlie what we were trying to do in opening up the experience, making and the thought of particularly video and photography were to the dimension of the multiplicity, is that all of these things are possible. The body can become implicated in the experience of it, and it doesn't take away from its video-ness or its photography-ness, you know. And that it's possible not to have that, and it actually adds to its to it being interesting, you see. And so, yeah, it's for precisely these concerns that we opened up some of the works to such expressions.
Okay, coming to the audience, I mean, how they engage in the different sites of exhibition. Also looking at, I'm particularly interested in the homes, which are not known for exhibition making, as against the ones that are the former places for exhibition making. If you had a chance to observe how the audience is interacted in different spaces.
I would say I didn't do a survey. I mean this very seriously. I didn't do the survey, but it is vital to note that some of the things that we were doing were not traditional procedures or processes in art. So, you have to take an approach that may be non-conventional or, improvised. So we had to mitigate that. There were just thousands of people who visit the show, especially for the professional week. So what you do is you create these experiences, diversifying it around different spaces. I'm sure some audiences would not see some or most of the works. Actually, it wasn't easy moving around the 11 sites, but we had a bus to facilitate this on the opening week. And so for me, the point is not that everybody experiences everything. Because there's a brochure or map, that lists the sites, it tells you who's where, you have the chance, you have the opportunity to select. Maybe in a week, you are there for just 2 days, but the point is that these options are available. So, I think that personally, I was at every site and I saw how, where some things worked, where some things didn't work, where some things needed to be done better. So then you work through it as you go. And I think that comes with the approach we took.
So before the exhibition, what were some of your fears?
What were some of my fears? I would say that it was a bit daunting to think about working on a show like this. It would have been different. So I also have to say that the Amoco experience would not be the same as if I was working on any other biennial, even in Africa, you see, for Dakar or Lubumbashi or something like that. It won't be the same. But this was particularly different. Some of the conditions we had to work under was that we had to work remotely for most of the time. So us as curators were not on site most of the time, and we're making production decisions and curatorial decisions virtually and remotely. And the challenges of not having the perfect team, the perfect technical team, and all of these things heightens this anxiety. We weren't sure that at every point you think it won't happen, you know, and some of the fears were that it would that it would not happen, quite literally. Yeah, for a long time you didn't know. There was very little visibility on just on a whole range of things. So you just have to keep up your spirit to say, okay, whether this works out or not, I'm here. I'm committed to it. But yeah, the financial side brought in a lot of anxieties. But then also then the on the side of the production, because at some point the printers while we were using, they would run out of ink, for example. Yeah. This is like 2 days before the opening. And it's just really, and there were times that for some of the state run institutions that we wanted to use, all of a sudden there was talk about having to pay a fee to use the sites, which you're not aware of before. So you just have to be on top of things, negotiating, you know, having hope that really. But it worked out well.
One question. I'm going to apologize because I think I'm going to ask the same question as somebody else. Actually, I'm not going to apologize because I was walking by, and then two of the men sitting outside saw me and said, there's a studio out there. And I'm like, music studio? It's like, yeah. So I said, oh, I'll come and check what the rates are. So if I don't give it better because I do visual arts. But I've been listening to you because I came late, but up to now I can't wake up where that happened. I've been trying to get up a clue from your presentation. I just want to know what country you are with.
So this is a presentation on the 12th edition of the Bamako Encounters Photography Bienal. It's based in the capital city of Mali, which is Bamako. So, and it has its history dating back to 1994. And the 12th edition is still ongoing. It ends tomorrow, the 31st of January. So if you can you can see it.
That would be hard considering I come from Malawi.
Right.
Somali and Malawi, that's okay.
Yeah, but thank you for that. It always helps to backtrack.
Okay, we can.
Please.
Yeah, you skipped the question of relevance. As a photographer myself, the Bamako contest has been, you know, the talk of the older generation, and also your interest with image making and your experiences is being personalized, of course, to the internet. So these have presented new ways of accessing like images and access work. I'm quite curious if you think this is still necessary and why you think so.
No, I think so. Let me say, I think it is relevant. I think that the Bamako Encounters in its current state has a place. I think it has a right to exist in the broader in the bigger picture of biennials around the world. But it's also the thing about how does it define or set this relevance, you know. I don't think, if you're asking a question about, you know, how platforms like Instagram and Snapchat or blogs like Tumblr could render printed map of photographs obsolete.
No,
I don't believe that.
No, no. The experience the photograph, like, is it still, are we becoming numb, or
yeah,
is still something that excites us, like, really want to get into?
Right. I think that it is all that. I think it is vital that we keep kind of expanding, you know, the possibilities of experience, the formal possibilities of what a photography or what the photograph itself is, right? And we have technologies today that exist that are doing that. And we have people who are interested in this. For example, Eugene, in his approach to photography, you see, he's very concerned not just about the outputs, the index of what is represented, if it's a face. You know, he's much more concerned about what's the physical and the chemical properties of, you know, these chemicals that come together when they interact with elements like light, and how they, you know, produce an image when you factor in time, you know, how time plays, how weather conditions, you know, affect differences in, you know, these little nuances. So if he produces 1,000 prints, you could see them as, or, you know, on the surface they look the same, but they are distinct. Each one is distinct. And what he did was he printed over 1,000 of those, you know, prints, and then made his installation. That's one example. In the biennial reader, there's a text by the micro-curator Aziz Ahanda, who deals with this question of the legacy and the future of the Bamako, right? For her, it has to, in order to live, it has to die, you know? And this is in the broader framework of how, yeah, the crisis that the large-scale format of exhibition making is experiencing at this moment in time, you see, uh-huh. And so, the question is one that I would say, yes, it has its place, but it can also grow. And that's where I'll leave for now.
Do we have access to it?
Well, at the moment, there are only a few issues, but the publisher is I'm sure you can find it online. The publisher, now that you asked me, it just escaped me. It's embarrassing, but it'll come. Archive Books, actually, they're based in Senegal. So please look online. Yeah, the catalog has the information on the artists and the works that were shown, and the reader has different contributions. So you have essays from Tate Cole, another many thinkers, like Kwee Jackson, Karina Jose Gu, has poems, anecdotes, essays dealing with these questions. There's no one answer, you know, but I think that it has its place. But it needs to redefine itself given the continuing conditions of today.
We'll take one more question, if not, we'll leave you for now. And thank you so much. Just put your hands together. Thank you, Christy, for very nice to meet you, Jack. The talk has come to you with collaborations from STU Accra, the Foundation for Contemporary Art, and the Yezid Frame. This happens every month. We try, right?
Yes.
Sometimes it happens more than one. We have more than one talk in a month. But at least every month we're sure to have a talk here. And also follow the STU Accra on Instagram on Twitter. You can follow the Foundation for Contemporary Art on Facebook, on Twitter. Visit us at our library, which is at the Du Bois Center, which has a lot of art books in there.
When is your library open?
Now it's open.
When?
It's from 10 to 7. At least you find someone there.
Every day.
If you make an appointment. But if you give me a call, we have somebody who's, because it's, we're still working cataloging the books. We also want to receive more books if you have some art books to give to your library. You find someone in there at least doing that work. If you want to join us, do that work also, you're welcome. You can also follow the as a frame on Instagram and on Twitter. Who else have we got? Any upcoming projects? Yes, follow his blog. We see on here, I'm busy. Bizzle at blogspot, right?
Thank you all for coming. It's been thank you for your question.
So the interaction continues. Thank you.
Next week we have Galileo. He has something special for us. So check at the studio on Instagram for more leads. Enjoy your evening.